I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Okay, so this is prime time for rare birds from out west, and I know you've talked a lot about this lark bunting, right, seen in Provincetown?
Yeah, I mean, and there's been so many others. something was going on. The weather obviously set up just right to bring a whole bunch of birds that have no business being here, and, you know, this is just... It's so fun for birders. You just never know what you're going to find when you go out to these hot spots, and people are just tripping over wacky, super rare birds. So there must have been some kind of easterly flow bringing some of these birds well off their track of where they should be migrating. They should be migrating south as well, not to Cape Cod. But this lark bunting, pretty obscure bird for your average person, but some birders found this guy just hopping around in the road up at Hatches Harbor. And this is a bird you would see like in the grasslands of Colorado, you know, out there in the grassy parts of the montane west. And a breeding male is a gorgeous bird, like black with this big white wing patch. Really interesting sparrow. They have winter and summer plumages, which is not typical for most sparrows. We tend to see these kind of drabber-looking ones that, you know, look like a big sparrow. People would be like, oh.
It's a sparrow.
Yeah. But a really interesting bird and, you know, like the seventh, I think, record ever for Massachusetts. So obviously very rare. I mean, we have such a long history of people documenting birds in Massachusetts. So to say it's the seventh record, that's up there with the really rare, rare of the rare. But it's continued and... you know, there's some traditional hot spots where you go to look for these things, especially on the Outer Cape. There's High Head and Truro. And then, you know, Fort Hill and Eastham is always just full of things. And they have come through. People found Western Kingbirds. People might be familiar with our Eastern Kingbird, which is a black and white bird that's here breeding in the summer. They're kind of fun. They chase things around. They chase crows, and they're really aggressive. but the kingbirds out west, kind of west from the Rocky Mountains and west, are yellow. They have yellow bellies. They look very different than ours. And we get them just about every year. They'll turn up here for some reason. And there were two at High Head sitting on the wires. Birders found those. And then Fort Hill, just Bell's Vireo, lark sparrow, all, you know, Bell's Vireos come as far as the Midwest, as close as the Midwest, but... just so many birds that don't belong here just turning up. And so there's more out there. The point is there's more of these out there, I guarantee.
And
Townsend Solitaire down by the lighthouse at Monomoy, another Rocky Mountain bird. So just an unusual number of these things out there. So the weather was right to bring them here. And I guarantee you there's more out there. People get out there looking.
And could we see more? I'm just thinking of, you know, that Hurricane Michael. Expected to hit in the Gulf. I mean, would something like winds like that bring birds this way?
No. I haven't really studied the path of that thing, but typically a Gulf, you know, one on that side of Florida isn't going to affect us too much.
I thought we were supposed to get some rain from it or something, so I thought maybe.
I don't. Yeah, it depends on how the winds set up afterwards. Yeah. It could, you know, if we get southerly winds. You get something called reverse migration, where birds that have already left here and on their way to Central and South America sometimes get caught up in...
Turned around.
Yeah. Right. And this often happens, if this happens just off the Atlantic coast of the southeastern states, if you get winds that blow back north, these birds will be kind of launching themselves from Florida, trying to get to Cuba or Venezuela, and then all of a sudden they're back on Cape Cod. And so if that, you know, I haven't really looked at what the predicted winds are for us following that storm, but there's always the potential if it brings kind of, you know, winds blowing from the south to the north that it will bring some interesting birds that we wouldn't normally see from the south, and also some of our migrants, things like hummingbirds that are pretty much gone from the Cape.
You know, I saw one last weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean...
Yeah.
But they're gone, so it's like very recently gone. So nobody has seen one since October 2nd that I'm aware of. So,
if you've seen one, then call us.
Yeah, yeah.
We want to know.
Yeah, let me know. I go by eBird, and nobody's reported one on eBird since October 2nd. I typically will get mine. Typically, will leave at the usual time, which is mid September, and then often I'll get a couple of more sightings at the end of September and into the first week of October. Like a migrant will stop by or something like that, but I didn't get this year, and my feeders are out, and the annuals that I bought to attract them are still blooming.
Yeah, I almost missed it. We have a guest bedroom, and outside that window there's the firecracker vine. And I was making the bed in there, and my grandson said, "Hummingbird!" And he looked out the window, and sure enough, there was a little hummingbird, and they sat in the maple tree for a little while.
Yeah,
and then we didn't see
good.
Him.
Yeah, again. Nice late one.
Yeah,
there certainly are late records and late migrants, but there's always this idea out there. A lot of people still ask this question. It's this time honored tradition to ask the question of bird experts: when do I take my hummingbird feeder down? And I'm always like, why do you take it? You don't need to take it down. People are afraid that they won't migrate or something. Like they'll forget
they
to migrate.
So go ahead, leave it up.
It
you never know,
work.
Right?
If you're someone who has hummingbird feeders, I mean, you must know that they're gone someday, even though your feeder is still full. The drive to migrate is very strong. Mm-hmm. They're not staying behind because, you've got sugar water in your feeder. They're programmed to fly to Central America, and they do that. I mean, my yard, the annuals that I had bought, the firecracker plant, which is
different than the firecracker vine.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm not as familiar with the vine, but it's a little red tubular flowers, and boy, they loved it. I mean, like 50 times a day they were visiting this flower, these two young ones that I had throughout the first half of September. And black and blue salvia, these all are still flowering. My pineapple sage hasn't even flowered yet. They're just starting to flower now, and it's an annual salvia with red tubular flowers. Mm-hmm. You can get it in nurseries, and that's one I always talk about. And it's one that if you have, you might get a late hummingbird coming to your yard if you have that. And it'll bloom through November. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that, we talked about those other Western vagrant songbirds, you get the same thing with hummingbirds. So I'm wondering if there are rufous hummingbirds and things out there that just haven't come to light yet, because we have all these other Western birds that have turned up on the Cape just in the last week and a half. And so if you have a pineapple sage, keep your feeders out and cleaned, and then call me when you get them.
Yeah. And if you do have hummingbirds, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint at capeandislands.org. So the firecracker vine is sort of red, yellow, white, and it does. It looks like a little, fireworks going off there up the vine. Very pretty annual. You have to plant it every year, but it's worth seeking out because it's the hummingbirds like it, and it's very pretty.
I know. These things are indulgent. I normally preach, native plantings, and there's certainly great native stuff that you should be planting for hummingbirds and whatever, but we're indulgent people, and we do this for us, and we buy annuals because they attract hummingbirds, and
because
that's fine.
It's climbing up where my honeysuckle bush is, but I cut it way back, so no flowers this year, so I put the vine there, so this year I would have some flowers on that trellis.
Oh, is it what kind of honeysuckle bush?
Oh, I don't know.
One of the Asian ones, I assume.
I'm probably probably I don't know. It's not one of the ones that's there. And then you mentioned Fort Hill. For people who have not visited Fort Hill, even if you don't see any rare birds, it is worth it. It's such a beautiful spot.
Oh yeah, it's top 10
gorgeous,
scenic spot in the state.
You have to go check it out. Yeah,
right. It's a gorgeous view across this kind of mowed hillside. The park doesn't really manage it for wildlife habitat. They have kind of strange mandates sometimes. They manage it as an anthropogenic habitat, which keeps it open, at least for wildlife. It's this big field complex. And then the hill goes down to one of the bigger salt marshes on the Cape, and you're looking across this giant salt marsh. Mm-hmm. To Coast Guard Beach and Nauset Spit and the inlet and out to the Atlantic Ocean. So, you can stand at Fort Hill and mm-hmm. see gannets and things and Jaegers going by pretty far away. And you get the salt marsh birds and all the songbirds and the thickets there.
Pretty.
It ticks all the boxes for a place you want to be in fall for regular migrants and rare things and everything. It's got a lot of different habitats coming together. It's sunny and it's right by the ocean, so things end up there.
And if you're not, if you can't walk a far way, right there in that parking lot, you can just pull right up in the parking lot, take your binoculars out, and you still will have, see some good stuff.
Yeah.
What about the Pacific loons? We've been seeing Pacific loons.
That was a little bit unusual. It seems early, mm-hmm. But there have been a few kind of early reports of Pacific loons. I feel like our typical loon migration hasn't even started yet, and people have gotten photographs of a beautiful breeding plumage Pacific loon. We don't typically see, you know, by the name, you wouldn't normally see Pacific loons at all. But we get a few every winter. Typically, Race Point is just... There's every winter. There's
so Race Point is
one
a good
two,
spot any time of the year.
Absolutely, and one or two Pacific loons. So that's, you know, you can see three species of loon around Race Point if you're lucky, and typically in the winter. But a nice breeding plumage one, people photograph there. It's a beautiful bird in breeding plumage, and we don't normally see that. We never hear them. I wouldn't have. I would have had no idea what that was.
Dan's thanks, quick, Dan.
Quick on the trigger there. Good work.
Who let
now
that
I know what they
here.
Sound
yeah,
like.
Yeah.
It sounds loony. You know, it's exactly. got that kind of common loon yeah. craziness.
And so we still have migration happening, right? So what are we looking at? What can we see migrating now?
There's sort of always migration happening, but boy, this is prime time. Late September, early October on the Cape, a lot of things are happening at once, starting to get... You know, more westerly winds that bring the vagrants, northwest winds that kind of pile up the normal migrants against the coast a little bit more. And so we're getting interesting warblers. We're getting the sparrow migration is beginning. And so people should be on the lookout under their feeders for interesting sparrows. You know, you might get a white-crowned sparrow or certainly white-throated sparrows will start coming in soon. So keep an eye out under your feeders for interesting sparrows. Fox sparrows show up later on. Look for them in November.
We have an awful lot of sparrows.
Song sparrow.
That's the one that I find so hard to identify are sparrows. They're tough.
Everybody has a hard time with sparrows. I do workshops on those little brown jobs, we call them. Mm-hmm. Call it my little brown job workshop. How to identify sparrows and confusing fall warblers. They're tough, too, this time yeah. of year. A lot of them are just sort of greenish and gray with an eye ring, you know.
Yeah.
speaking of which, Connecticut warblers have been turning up. One of my favorites, a really, you know, an obscure bird for the average person. And really, even obscure ornithologically, still kind of a poorly understood warbler, a skulker. You know, they tend to be on the ground or in low, dense vegetation this time of year. They breed really sparsely in boreal, like black spruce bogs from kind of Minnesota northwards into Canada. And then they disappear into the Amazon, just into heart of darkness, Amazonia and Brazil and in the winter. And so they're poorly understood in their breeding range, they're poorly understood in migration, and they're poorly understood in their wintering range. So even after all this time of, you know, ornithological study, they're one of those ones that we still have a lot of question marks about. And that gives them an air of mystery to me. I really like Connecticut warblers. And birders always really love turning one up because they're kind of tough. A couple have turned up at Sue Finnegan's banding station there on Wing Island. We've had them at we've had at least one at the sanctuary in Wellfleet at our banding station. Always a fun one to see. But they're just sort of yellowy, like a drab yellowy green, kind of a grayish head and a complete eye ring. Mm. They're a nice looking little bird.
Speaking of the sanctuary, do we have a lot of things going through? That's another great spot to kind of just go inside that little area there where you can look out to the feeders and see all kinds of stuff.
The sanctuary is always good. I mean, it's been particularly good the last couple of weeks for terns and wading birds. So at the sanctuary in Wellfleet, we have this Hatches Creek that kind of empties out at right where our beach is. If you go hike the trails out to our beach, this creek, there's creeks on either side of our beach, kind of emptying out there. And so on a falling tide, there have been a lot of shorebirds. We've had some interesting ones like Hudsonian Godwit, a couple of stilt sandpipers. Red knots have been regular, and they're typically not regular at our beach. Red knots, these long-distance migrants on their way to Tierra del Fuego.
Dan is on it this morning. Huh?
Yeah, it's like, I'll take obscure bird calls for 200, Alex. I don't even know what that was. That was a red knot? Okay. I guess I should know that. They're not super vocal when they come through here. Some of these shorebirds that, you know, they have songs on the Arctic, these high Arctic breeding grounds that I have not been to. But anyway, and lots of herons and egrets, you know, stuff that people can get behind. Mm. Big charismatic birds.
Beautiful
that
birds,
even
yeah.
kind of, you know, people who aren't hardcore birders can certainly get into. I mean, you could see 25, 30 snowy egrets, several great egrets all kind of lined up in the creek with hundreds of laughing gulls, and we have tons of Forster's terns, which is kind of a specialty bird of ours this time of year. You might see 100, 150 Forster's terns on a good day. And most places, even good birding spots like in Chatham, you typically don't see any, or you just see a couple. And they don't breed in Massachusetts. I'm not even sure where they come from, whether they come up from the south to stage here before they migrate, or they're coming from like an upper Midwest population. So that's still kind of a mystery. So Forster's terns, there's still common terns around. And so there's these feeding frenzies, birds feeding on fish as these creeks are emptying out on the dropping tide. It's been really nice. So yeah, the sanctuary is really nice this time of year. It's good, good shoulder season thing to do.
Come
hike our trails,
exactly.
And see our new exhibits. Check out our banding station Sunday mornings. You can do public banding demonstrations, and we have other bird walks and things. So come check it out.
It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, 866-999-4626 for your comments, questions, or stories. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking mostly birds, but we're going to talk about squirrels and spiders, too, after break.
We are.
You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. For your bird comments, stories, questions, or other critters, we'll talk about them too. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Marcia sends an email. She says, so many years ago, 1999, I had elf owls in my yard, heard them at night, and identified them from Cornell bird sounds and from their planned attack on the wasp nest in my outdoor shower. They were using Cornell's so-called mewing sound in the planning, which was a sound I'd never heard, then swooped up into the shower. Happily for me, they took the whole nest. I report this because there were fires in Colorado that year, and this year there were fires in Colorado as well. So perhaps the western birds stay on their latitudes but fly greasy distances to escape the fire.
Boy, what? In God's name. Elf owls where? Where does this person live?
It does not say where.
I don't know what to do with that. Yeah. Elf owls breed in the desert southwest. I used to work, do research in the desert southwest. I love that area. It's awesome birding, awesome wildlife. And it was a point of pride that we had an elf owl. I lived in the cottonwood forest at the edge of the desert down there in this kind of wildernessy area, and we had elf owls there. But I don't know. Outside shower, wasp nest, elf owls. I don't know what.
Yeah, I don't know. She shouldn't say if that was out west somewhere, if that was here. But anyway, I've never seen an elf owl.
No elf owls here. Yeah. I don't know. It's misidentification, or they didn't say that they actually live in Arizona. I don't know what.
Do owls take wasp nests? Is that something owls would do? Any kind of owl?
You know, I don't know if elf owls would do that. I mean, some of the small owls are opportunistic, and though they prefer to eat mice, like screech owls will eat insects. They'll eat moths and beetles and things, certainly. There's an owl out west, a flammulated owl, that I think is pretty insectivorous. But I don't know about elf owls and wasp nests. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do with that one.
Stumped with that one. All right. Hey, we should talk about West Nile. This has been a tough year for some crows, right? Are crows the only, any of the birds get
jays? Crows and jays are both corvids. They're in that family, and they're closely related. You know, ravens presumably would be susceptible. But there's been some talk kind of around here that people are seeing dead crows. And I'm sure it's West Nile virus. And then jays, you know, there's an influx of jays. I think we might talk about that later. But, they get it too. And so you probably heard it's a big West Nile virus year. And they used to test birds, but they don't anymore. The state doesn't want dead birds to test. They found that it doesn't work as well as testing the mosquitoes. And so they just say bury it. It's safe to just, you know, bury it in your yard if you do have dead birds. They know about it. It's a thing. You know, I'd say 17 or 18 years ago, there was a major West Nile outbreak, certainly within bird populations that really knocked crow populations down.
I remember particularly that.
Off Cape, probably around here too. Not so much on the outer Cape, but definitely off Cape and like Bristol County, places like that. Crow numbers were way down because of West Nile virus and took it a long time to recover. And so maybe we're reaching that point in the cycle again, and they're going to take another hit. But remains to be seen. But you don't need to call anybody right now.
Right.
They don't want to test your dead birds. They know about there's West Nile mm-hmm. out there, and so you can just bury it.
Yep. All right. Joan is calling from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. On Sunday, I was coming back from Orleans along Route 28 in South Orleans, just past Tarkiln Road. There's a dip in the road and by the bay, and there was a duck standing in the middle of the road.
Yeah.
And it was standing up tall. This is around noon or maybe 1 o'clock. It was a tall, skinny, gray duck, and the traffic came to a halt in both directions, thankfully. And some lady finally gave up and got out of her car and headed towards it, and it said, oh, no, and it ran across in front of my lane and turned around and took off and flew out over the bay. But it was a tall, skinny, gray duck. I have no idea what that could possibly be. I was 5 cars back, so I couldn't see it that clearly.
Tall, skinny, gray duck. You sure it was a duck? Did it walk
like a duck?
Like a duck? Did it quack like a duck?
I didn't hear it.
You have to ask yourselves these questions.
It was standing up tall and straight and skinny. It did, you know, when it took off, you know, ran in front of the other cars out of sight, it stayed tall and skinny.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's a posture that ducks will have when they're standing on dry land and they're alert, as I assume this one would be, to not get run over.
Yeah.
Gray.
It's gray all over. It was light gray.
Hmm.
It probably was a female of some sort, or maybe a juvenile of some sort.
Yeah. Don't know. Could that have been just somebody's, you know, domestic duck that got loose?
Who knows?
Yeah.
I would love to see a photo of whatever this was. Yeah. Ducks hang out in roads sometimes. Did you say there was water in the road?
There wasn't, but the tide was really high, and there was some sort of activity at the yacht club there. Boat sailing club, and they may have startled the bird out of the water onto the road because it only had a few feet to go from the water onto 28.
Hmm.
Yeah. No, I'm not sure. I've seen ducks in parking lot puddles mm-hmm. after heavy rains. Yeah. Mallards will just move in any kind of water. They love ephemeral pools, right? And few things are more ephemeral than a parking lot puddle. And I've seen mallards in black ducks in parking lot puddles before, so they'll do that, but in terms of this guy, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to be, I guess, perplexed
totally
on that one.
Though.
Yep.
And I was thankful for the people stopped.
Yeah. All right, Joan. Thanks for sharing. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right. So let's talk about the winter finch forecast.
Oh yeah. So this is a fun thing. Every year, there's a guy named Ron Pittaway. He's a birder in Canada, in Ontario, and he's also a forester. And he's been interested in these winter finches for many years. And every year, he puts out a forecast. And so the winter finches are birds whose breeding range is primarily Canada. They're boreal forests, you know, mostly the coniferous forests of Canada and Alaska. And we never know when we're going to see them, because they don't breed in Massachusetts and they don't have predictable migrations like, you know, every year the warblers migrate south and they go to the same place and they come back at the same time and all that. These guys, they do what they want. And they're responding to mysterious cycles in seed crops in the different kinds of trees across the boreal belt of Canada. and we're talking about species like red crossbills, white wing crossbills, common red poles, pine grosbeaks, evening grosbeaks, pine siskins, purple finches, and then even some things that aren't really finches that get honorary status because they are also eruptive, and that's what we're talking about. Instead of being migratory, they erupt southwards at somewhat unpredictable intervals based on food resources in their breeding range. And so... we've been seeing red-breasted nuthatches in pretty high numbers, and that's usually a good indicator that we might see some of these winter finches that we haven't seen in some cases in several years. And so you may have noticed red-breasted nuthatches at your feeders that weren't there before. It can be a little hard to detect an influx of them on the Cape just because we have them anyway. We have, you know, we have a lot of pitch pine woodlands, and so mm-hmm. we have breeding red-breasted nuthatches. But there have been many more than usual, and they've come down from Canada because cone crops, like spruce cone crops, are not very high this year, and so they have to come south looking for food. The red poles are looking at birch catkins, so those kind of cones that hang down, those thin little cone-like things that hang down from birch trees, that's what red poles depend on, these little beautiful streaky little finches with red on the head and on the breast. And a lot of these birds you might get at your feeders. So this is relevant to the backyard bird watcher mm-hmm. as well as the hardcore birder. So red poles might come to your thistle feeders if you put, Niger seed out. That's where they would show up, but they could show up on the ground as well under your feeders.
This is an interesting little report. I went in and checked it out because it talks about each of these birds and what they eat, so you can, you know.
Right. So
what kind of seed you in your feeders that what birds you want to attract?
Yeah. So he has a network of people across the boreal region that he polls starting in late summer. You know, what are the cone crops like? Are they good, fair, poor in your region? Are you seeing these birds? And and then he puts that all together and he makes a prediction. And this year, it's basically like you're going to see winter finches. And it's often more ambiguous than that. You know, he's mm-hmm. not really sure. But it's with some of these species, it seems like we should definitely see them. So, you know, keep an eye out for white-winged crossbills, particularly in like the outer Cape. The outer half of the Cape tends to get those when they're around. I don't know if they're coming over the water down mm-hmm. from Newfoundland or what the deal is, but... they're looking for food, and I'm really hoping we'll get red poles because, you know, I just really like these birds.
And blue jays were on that list, and it says, I guess they're seeing a large flight of them along the north shorelines of Lakes Ontario and Erie. Acorn, beechnut, hazelnut crops were poor to low in central Ontario and Quebec, so that means they're heading a little south to find food, right?
Yeah. And so blue jays respond to acorns primarily around here. We don't have a lot of beech and mm-hmm. hazelnut around here. And they're fun because they migrate during the day, unlike a lot of songbirds that are migrating at night when we can't see them. Blue jays will just migrate, you know, the middle of the day in big flocks sometimes. And so we might see more of those. Now, we've had years where we had no blue jays because we didn't have any acorns.
Mm-hmm. I guess last fall was the bumper acorn crop because this is why we're seeing all those dead squirrels on the roads in New Hampshire and Maine. I mean, like hundreds of them.
Right. And I just got back from southern Maine. And so generally speaking, the trees that produce seeds, whether it's acorns or spruce cones or pine cones or whatever, have boom and bust years, right? It's not the same every year. And so it might be 10 years between big crop years for certain trees in a certain region. And so it seems like last year, I'm guessing it was northern red oaks must have had a big mast year. Mast meaning acorns in mm-hmm. the case of oak trees. Mast just means seed production for trees. You have soft mast, which would be fruiting trees, and then hard mast, which would be like acorns and beech nuts and things. And so I'm guessing northern red oaks had a big mast year last year. They had a big mast year last year because there's like a biblical plague of squirrels in southern Maine.
And, mm-hmm. and New Hampshire, yeah.
And and everybody was talking about it, and I started looking on the highway. For some reason, I was oblivious to it on the way up. I counted over 1 mile of highway in southern Maine, 30 dead squirrels, mm-hmm. and I was just... This is like big four, it was like 95. This isn't some little country road. And so they're really making an effort to cross this gigantic highway because there's so many of them and they're dispersing to find new areas that aren't, you know, overloaded with squirrels and where they can find food. And so I was really just counting this little 5-foot strip to the left between the passing lane and the median. Yeah. And 30 in a mile. And
it's crazy.
It was unbelievable how many there were. And I remember this happened on the Cape maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember exactly, but we had one of these explosions of squirrels because of a good acorn year the year before. And I remember seeing one swimming across the Southway in Chatham on its way to South Beach. It was swimming to a treeless barrier beach. Like, there were just so many squirrels and so little food that they were just like, get me out of here. And they were trying to get anywhere.
Yeah.
Swimming across saltwater.
Well, that's I was reading an article, and some biologists were saying that part of the reason for these squirrels going across the highways is they're desperate. They've had, you know, not a lot of water. They're more susceptible to disease, and they're maybe not making the smartest decisions that they would if they were in good health. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Lee sends an email. I recently saw a cartoon with two men speaking with one another. We sent a man to the moon. We created the internet, but we can't keep squirrels out of our bird feeders. So true.
It is.
Yeah. If anybody knows how. Those weighted bird feeders work pretty well.
Yeah. It's one of the great challenges of our time.
That's right.
Together we can do it. No, I know it's silly, but yes, I consider them almost foolproof. The ones where it's simply a cage on springs that and when the squirrel gets on it, it weighs too much and it pulls the cage down over the feeding ports and it can't get at them. You know, it might be able to shake it around and then go eat the seed on the ground or something, but they can't park themselves on your feeder and eat all your seed.
Boy, do they try.
They give up. In my experience, I have found them to be pretty much foolproof. What it doesn't work against is chipmunks.
Oh,
and so those little guys,
they can get
those
them,
little jerks, they sit on mine and they weigh as much as a bird, so they don't trip the springs.
That's funny.
And they just chow.
Yeah, I don't know. Chipmunks are so cute, though. I mean, they're just
so cute. Oh, I know. I love
so
chipmunks.
Cute. All right, John is giving us a call. John from the Hyannis Whale Watch. Good morning, John.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Hello, John.
I figured I'd give a holler here because it's probably our last report from the water. Well, it will be because I won't be out there.
Okay.
After about the 26th. So our birds have been good. It's been the best birds we've had the past 3 weeks or so for the whole season for us. Some of our shearwaters, like manxes, which we hadn't seen many of all summer, have come in good numbers, and we're plenty of Cory shearwaters. But we're starting to get some of our, you know, our fall specialties here. We're seeing a lot of parasitic Jaegers. We've had a couple of Pomeranes further offshore, and one South Polar Skua. That was fun.
Really nice bird.
That is a nice bird.
Hell yeah.
And we picked up the brown booby the other day too, who's floating around Stell Wagon, so that was exciting as well.
Oh, really?
And some Fulmars. Yeah.
I haven't seen any reports. That's really nice. Yeah, I haven't seen any reports of that
out
lately.
Out in full splendor, you know, and in with some gannets, which makes it a lot easier because they're so much smaller.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Very nice.
But the other day you were mentioning migration, and we had, as we often do, we had a desperate little songbird circling off on Stell Wagon Bank, circling our boat. And as we always do, we encourage people, you know, just if it lands on you, let it. It's a tired bird that came down from all the way from Canada probably last night, crossed the whole Gulf of Maine.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's one of the fun things this time of year is these songbirds that end up out over the water that will end up on boats. And it just shows you what they're going through. I mean, these tiny little birds, and you think about where it came from or how far it's flown over water and how much further it has to go. It's just amazing.
Yeah. What about
in this case? In this case, it was a little Nashville warbler, and our passenger scooped it in his hat. I didn't know that he'd done it at the time. I would have kind of have to let nature take its course out there, but he put it in his hat dutifully, and we gave it a ride back in. I only discovered this when I went down to secure the boat for getting people off, and the bird was flying in our cabin, so good. So we quickly got him tucked away, and with the aid of about three of our youngest passengers on board between about 4 and 6 years old, we all went out and let it go. You know, a couple of them didn't speak English as their first language or any English. And it was fun because you could see there was a real universal joy in watching this little tired little bird fly right into the, shrubbery and probably get right to the job of feeding itself for the rest of its life.
Yeah, that's great.
That's a trip they won't forget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah,
they call that ship-assisted migration.
Ship-assisted migration.
No, they do. I mean, that's it happened with some snowy owls. The big snowy owl eruption year several years ago, they documented that some snowy owls ended up on a boat bound for Europe. And so they took a boat from Canada to Europe, and then they watched them fly onto mainland Europe from this boat. So it, ship-assisted birds is a thing.
John, what about the whales? How's it been for whale watching?
It has been an odd year, and I think we spoke about that before just because of our prey base. We had such a low number of sand eels. But a lot of our whales have moved on, and now we're starting to see some of our we're starting to see a lot of the humpbacks that we expect to see are moving out slowly. They're getting pickier on the times that they feed. They're not wasting energy at this point. They're almost to their quota and they're only feeding. So there's whales out there. They're often doing deep dives, and we're seeing a lot of individuals that we associate more with the northern Gulf of Maine whales that normally would be spotted up toward, you know, off of Bar Harbor or off of Nova Scotia or further up. So it's an exciting time.
Yeah.
It keeps us on our toes. Who's this that's come up by the boat?
Yeah. Well, John, thanks for that report. We appreciate that. It's always, I mean, it's worth going on the whale watch just to see the birds. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Good times.
All
well,
right.
We'll hope to speak to you over the winter, and we'll be back in touch in April.
You bet. Thanks for the call, John. We appreciate it. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Marcia wrote back about the elf owl. She says, I live in Cummaquid. Since it was night, I could only hear them, so looked up insect-eating owls because it was at night and identified them from their bird sounds. She says, you're not the first to dismiss the ID, but I figure you're familiar with elf owls' mewing sound. The point is, how far will birds migrate from fire, as perhaps the rare western larks have?
No, I don't think that's what's happening. It's more weather-based, like winds bringing them, because this is the time of year when they would be migrating, not fleeing fire. And so I think this is a typical thing where birds get off track. Prevailing winds will pick, you know, take them off course, or a lot of them just have something wrong in their navigational systems. They're kind of inborn navigational systems, and you'll get birds that fly 90 degrees in the wrong direction and things like that. And mirror image errors in migration. There's been a lot of opining about what that is. In terms of fleeing fires, a lot of birds actually are attracted, fly into fire.
Recently
burned areas green up again very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll get a flush of energy insects.
Mm-hmm.
And there are birds that, there are some woodpeckers that, and insects that are able to detect fires at long distances. There are some insects that will fly to a fire because they can then take advantage of the fire-weakened trees and lay their eggs, and their larvae will eat the trees, and then that attracts certain woodpeckers, like black-backed woodpeckers. They love to be in recently burned areas. So fire is often a kind of a short-term attractant for a lot of species of bird. And, you know, there can certain big fires that, you know, in areas where there was too much fuel and they hadn't been burned in a long time because we're sort of mismanaging the landscape, you know, those can be devastating for certain species. But also there are other species that will benefit from it. And fire's always been a natural part of the landscape. Certainly grasslands, dry pine-based, pine-dominated woodlands. These are fire-maintained ecosystems. And so the animals and the birds evolved with that too.
Mm-hmm. All right. Changing the subject here, I'm talking about spiders. In my grandson's bedroom, we have this great big beautiful spider that's been there I want to say for a couple months now. We've been watching, and it's really great because he had mentioned that he wakes up with nightmares, and so I said, maybe you need a dream catcher. And he said, yeah. And I said, do you know what a dream catcher is? Yes, it catches bad dreams. And that was the day we had discovered the spider web in the window. So we came home and I looked up online. I found a dream catcher that kind of looked like a spider web with the spider in the middle. I said, look at this dream catcher. This looks just like our spider web in your window. I think that is your dream catcher. So he said,
nicely done.
I know, right? And then I said, so what do you think is going to happen when that spider web catches your bad dreams? What's that spider going to do? And he said, he's going to eat it, and he's really hungry. Well, he's gotten, I think it's a she. She has gotten much bigger.
It's usually a she.
And it's been exciting for him to watch her catch these little insects and wrap the, you know, and then fix her web. But it is, I'm pretty sure it's a cross orb weaver, which I had never heard of before.
Yeah, I saw the picture. And I'm not a spider. I have to look up every spider just about, and I know where to look, but it's challenging. I send people to bugguide.net, which is an expert crowdsourced site of curated and properly identified pictures of insects, you know, sorted by taxonomy. It's a great site, and you can usually puzzle out your spider that way. You need some kind of prerequisite knowledge to kind of get through it, but yeah, this is an introduced spider. Unfortunately, it's a
European
species
garden,
that's been introduced here.
And no bad dreams. The spider's doing the job.
Brilliant. We should all. Now I can make the case to my wife that we don't have to get rid of all the spiders.
No, well, it's outside. It's not inside the window. It's on the outside of the window, so I'm good with that.
Right.
And
so, okay,
I guess
she would allow that. That would be considered. She has a trustworthiness scale for spiders.
And this is the time of year, I guess, that they lay their eggs. So maybe we'll see a whole bunch of baby spiders. I don't know.
You might be wishing you hadn't left the dream catcher then. But
no.
Well, they might try to get into the house for the winter.
Oh,
but yeah, I'm fully in favor of leaving spiders in your house, around your house. I love jumping spiders. They don't meet my wife's trustworthiness scale.
Yeah, so jumping spiders kind of freak me out, too.
Well, they don't.
They don't bite or anything. But
well, she thinks they jump at your face. Like, well, if they jump, then they obviously they're going to jump on your face. And they don't. They're great. They catch flies around your windows and things. And, they're like having a little tiger that in your window that jumps and catches flies. I hate flies buzzing around my house. So I want more jumping spiders.
All right. Well, I'm going to be very sad when my European garden spider is gone. But we did buy a dream catcher to replace it when the spider
was good.
Gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Backup dream catcher. And these orb weavers are often beautiful, beautiful spiders.
They are. It's beautiful. And not only the web is also, it takes up the whole top part of the window. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. I mean, talk about a sense of wonder. I mean, just the fact that they can construct that and just how amazing spider web is as a material. And, materials engineers are, always trying to replicate it and just how beautiful they are. Yeah, spiders are great.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right. Black skimmers. Where are we seeing black skimmers?
Yeah. I don't know what's going on. There's this youth gang of black skimmers that are they're all juveniles. Juveniles have a really distinctive plumage, and they've been seen. Most people have seen them at Seagull Beach in Yarmouth, but they've also been seen at Red River Beach, so two different Nantucket Sound beaches. And there's either seven or eight, and it's just not a common bird on the Cape. You see one now and again. They used to breed more around Monomoy, but now pretty much all of the skimmers. And we're talking less than 10 pairs, I think, or maybe around 10 pairs or a little over. They're all on Martha's Vineyard. So they've kind of cornered the market on breeding black skimmers. It's more of a southern bird, and they don't breed other places in the state anymore. And they've been banding them over there. So if you see a black skimmer, look for leg bands. This is kind of a new, relatively new project bird research-wise where they're putting field-readable leg bands on black skimmers. So it's worth going to these places because it's an unusual bird. They're really interesting. Their natural history, just the whole, they're the only bird in the world where the lower mandible is longer than the upper one. So they've got this crazy underbite, and it's very functional. It's in order to, they drag that longer lower bill through the water, often at dusk, and they detect fish by feel and just have this lightning quick response. They snap up that bill on bait fish that are hanging near the surface. That's their MO. That's how they eat. They skim the water, and so sometimes at dusk you'll just see this you'll see this thing breaking the water, kind of moving across, and then your eyes resolve that that's a black skimmer. But an unusual sight around here, much more common down south. Like if you went to Florida for the winter, you'd see big flocks of them on some of the good birding beaches down there. Seven is a lot. And so I'm not sure where they came from or how long they'll hang out, but it's worth checking out if you've never seen one before.
I've noticed I'm not seeing as many tufted titmice in my, flying around in my yard. Is there something happening with them, or is it just maybe because I don't have the feeders up, they're not coming to my yard anymore?
No, I mean, they've been on a steady increase for years, mm-hmm. like a lot of the southern birds that have moved their way north. I didn't have as many this year as last year, but it was an extremely local phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Last year, I had like 8 chicks fledged from a box outside my bedroom window, and they were around the neighborhood. You know, I think they fledge chicks elsewhere. I mean, there's certainly a flock of titmice in my neighborhood, but sometimes it's a very local phenomenon. Like your local pair didn't produce chicks this year, and they tend to produce a big gang of, you know, they fledge a lot of chicks. And so in a whole flock of 8 or 10 birds could be, you know, one family group.
Wow. All right. Let's talk to Paul, who's calling from Dennis. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I'm starting to wonder if I have some demented birds that have arrived in my yard. I just put up, about a month ago, I put up 2 great big bird feeders, and I have a bird bath out in the middle of the garden. And we have had a zillion different birds show up at the bird feeders.
That's
a
lot.
We have about 5 or 6 mourning doves that are constantly around the bottom of the bird feeders. And when they get through eating, they fly up to the bird bath, and they take a drink, and then they turn around and put their butt end in, and I think they use it as a toilet.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Every single day, it's filled with...
I know.
Yeah.
I know. I've had the same thing. Morning doves can be a little annoying. They're not very bright. You know, they flew the other way when God was giving out bird brains. I've had a lot of experience with them. I've been different nest searching work I've done around the country where I've monitored bird nests and for different research projects, and they're not too bright. They don't seem to be great parents, but they're just everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're whatever they're doing, they're producing lots of young, and they're very extremely successful bird that can nest in, you know, creosote bush desert in Arizona, as you know, up into Canada. Spruce forest. So they're very successful, and I don't know, somehow pooping in your bird bath is part of that magic that makes them so successful. But it's annoying because I feel like I constantly have to change out the water, and I do suspect it's them. I think other species will do it too, and it just seems you're right. It's puzzling. It seems like it would be maladaptive because you would think there would be diseases that would get transmitted that way. But who knows? There might be some parasite that compels them to do it. And this is a thing where parasites change the behaviors of their host in a way that that serves their reproductive goals. So a parasite will cause some insect to crawl to the top of a blade of grass and just stay there. And then its babies will hatch out. And, you know, there's things like that where they take over the brains of their host. And I'm wondering, I'm just totally spitballing here. I'm wondering if there is some parasite that compels birds to poop in the water, and then they can transmit it to a new host. Is there a parasitologist in the house? Can someone please call in?
All right. Well, Paul,
I have something else.
Really quick. We have 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Real quick. My daughter-in-law came up with a solution for a pipe that holds up the bird feeders for not having squirrels run up it.
Oh.
She puts a, one of those spring-loaded toy things that the kids have.
Yep.
She runs that up the pipe.
A slinky?
I put one on. The zinc, yeah.
Slinky.
The slinky method. I like it.
Yeah.
Patent that.
I put one on, and the squirrels do not go up it. They go up about 1.5 feet, and then they give up and jump back off of it.
All right. We'll have to try that. Thanks,
you
Paul.
You heard it here first, folks.
Slinky. Try the slinky on the pole. All right. Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us the second Tuesday of every month. See you next month.
We'll see you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.